afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4.
It's so
FM.
Faint I can scarcely hear you. It's no good.
Hello, Morris.
Ah, that's a bit better. It's a bad line. It's very faint.
Okay.
Now, I think before it, you said, I was told just now it's going live to line, to the air. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Well, in that case, I think that I wasn't quite ready for that. I thought it was going to be a recording. I think I'd better just read through these things first.
Yeah.
And practice reading them, because I don't want to hiccup on air.
Well, we have to go with it now, Morris. So just have a go. It doesn't matter if you can rehearse on air. That'll be fine.
Rehearse on air.
Hmm.
All right. Well, I'll have to do that then.
All right. So basically, you're going to read out a Christmas message from Wavelength.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, in various languages.
That's correct.
All right. Okay, well, you can proceed at your own pace.
And I beg the listeners to have understanding for the fact that this is unexpectedly going out live, which is not really a very good thing, as I'm not fully practiced in it yet, in getting the word sequence right and so on.
All right.
However, I'll do my best.
Okay.
Are we ready?
Yes,
right.
Yes, fine.
Il programma lunghezza d'onda, vi auguri un Natale serenissima e un anno nuovo sano e prosperoso. Die Programmwellenlänge wünscht euch ein frohe Weihnachten und ein gesunde, erfolgreiche neues Jahr. La programme longueur d'onde vous souhaite un bon Noël et une nouvelle année sain et plein de bien-être. The program Wavelength wishes you a happy Christmas and a healthy, prosperous new year.
That was great. Thank you, Morris. Thank you very much.
Has that arrived satisfactorily?
Yes, that was loud and clear. Thank you.
And have you recorded it?
It will be recorded, yes, but it went out, it's gone out live.
It's gone out live?
Oh, yes, but it's being recorded as well.
Would it not have been better to record it first just to check it and then send it out live?
Yes and no. But what are you doing for Christmas? Let's.
I'm not doing anything for Christmas. As far as I'm concerned, one day is like every other.
Oh, really? Yeah. How are you keeping...
I can't afford to. It's technically difficult from the point of view of having many dogs, leaving them alone for a long time. It's also a time of rumple and rummel, and it's a commercial razzmatazz, which is really rather unfortunate.
Yes. Yes, I know what you mean. But how are you keeping warm out there?
Well, I have my electrically heated clothing, which you know about, which I invented years ago, many, many decades ago.
Yep.
And that is invaluable because it enables me to keep myself warm, even in a cold environment, for an expenditure of wattage much, much lower than it would be if I was using electric room heating.
Yeah, yeah.
But, of course, that can only be used part of the time. Much of the time, I am dependent on room heating, and that involves 50-year-old German fan heaters, thermostatically controlled, in the room that I'm actually using. So I heat one room, and the others are merely kept at a mere tick-over of warmth, just enough to stop them freezing.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
When I move into one or other of those rooms, I then turn up the thermostat, but only for the period that I'm there.
So
and that's how it works.
Why do you think that heated clothing hasn't caught on particularly...
Well, it's funny you should say that. Something very odd has happened. I understand that currently there are firms who are marketing all sorts of pirated versions of my old inventions of all those years ago. Somebody told me only the other day that heated clothing was, quote, using their words, not mine, selling like hot cakes.
Oh, really? All right.
Now, I have been advised, I don't know if this is right or wrong, that inasmuch as I invented many of these things a long time ago, and there is plenty of backup evidence to prove it, in the form of videotapes of television broadcasts and sound recorded tapes of radio broadcasts and press reports, I'm told, I don't know if there's any truth in this, that if I were to take the matter to a solicitor, I might be able to get damages from the people who are pirating it.
Yeah.
I've no idea if that's true or not. What do you think?
Well, it's a lengthy process, isn't it? Once you get into sort of legal matters, it can be very expensive, especially if you don't win the case or something.
This is what I fear would happen. So I think the answer is I can't do anything about it. But it would do no harm, I suppose, to give publicity to the fact that this is the present situation, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. So what do? You also have a windmill, don't you, which sort of powers the electricity?
I have a very small wind generator on a tower, and it's more a symbol than anything else, because the amount of energy it produces is exceedingly small by comparison with what is used. But it does contribute in a small way, and it does constitute an exposition of the principle which we should all be following in a very much bigger way than we are.
Yeah. And how long have you had the windmill?
Oh, the wind generator has been there. Well, I arrived here 50 years ago, and I think it probably was erected virtually straight away.
Gosh, right. Yes.
It's still there. It ticks over gently. Yeah. And it's quite a sort of landmark, as you may have noticed.
Yeah. And is that powerful enough to heat the heated clothing?
No, no.
Oh.
Only in freak conditions of gale,
yeah,
would it produce enough to operate the heated clothing. It operates enough for the energy to be stored in batteries and to contribute to the general overall consumption of the heated clothing.
Right.
But
right.
It certainly doesn't provide all the heated clothing power, no.
Okay.
It's partly a financial matter. You see, these wind generators, if they're at all substantial, are very costly things indeed.
Yeah. So you sort of move around the house then, just re-plugging yourself in different rooms.
Indeed. I have a cable hanging from my waist. I'm handling it now. And it has a little plug, a little two-pin plug on the end of it, and a fuse, an inline fuse. And when I arrive in another room, if it's cold, now at the moment I'm in the bathroom. Well, it isn't cold in here, and I don't need to plug it in. But if we were to talk, say, for half an hour, then I would get a little cold, and I would plug it in to the low-voltage mains,
yeah,
which are fed by a large number of large rechargeable batteries disposed outside the building.
Yes.
And they're connected into various rooms, so I can plug in most rooms. And when I get warm enough, I plug out.
Yeah, yeah.
But equally, I have a walking aid which takes the form of a shopping trolley, a four-wheeled shopping trolley, which gives me support for my disabilities when I walk. And in the shopping trolley, there is, amongst other things, a fairly heavy battery. And when I'm out of doors, both when I'm walking along and when I'm stationary, when I'm indoors or outdoors or in somebody else's vehicle or somebody else's premises, I can plug in to the walking aid, and that will then power my heated clothing.
Oh, right, right. Is that like a car battery?
No, no, it's much smaller than a car battery.
Uh-huh.
It's possibly a third or a quarter of the weight of a car battery.
Yeah.
But it's quite a hefty lump.
Yeah, yeah. So you push that round with you in the trolley?
The trolley, and wherever I go, it goes with me. And if I get cold, I just plug into the trolley.
So how are you coping with the increase in gas and electricity bills?
Well, I find that exceedingly difficult, and I've reached the stage, it's a negative situation, where my rate of expenditure is fairly considerably in excess of my very humble, modest, limited income. And I've got to do something about it, and what I'm going to do, I just don't know at the moment. The heated clothing does help enormously, because it means I can cut down the use of the fan heaters.
Yeah.
They're the main gobblers of current.
Yeah.
But in the long run, I'm going to have to find some additional source of income. So although I'm retired, I must try and find some sort of little part-time activity, whatever it may be, which brings in a little money to augment the much diminished pension due to my being a victim of the Equitable Life collapse.
Yeah. And that was, I suppose you could conceivably use your, I mean, you have a very good speaking voice, which perhaps you could make money from that somehow.
I have the feeling that if one could only find the right way of applying it, that, coupled with my knowledge of languages, might conceivably be useful to some organization or person who might be willing to pay for it in money.
Yeah.
Now, how one goes about finding someone who wants that facility, I really don't know.
Well,
but it might be.
Yeah. Where did you do elocution? Did you have elocution lessons or anything?
No, I've never had elocution lessons. I was brought up in a quadrilingual family. My mother was Hanoverian German, but partly French. We had Italian connections as well, and my father, who was an absentee, was English. And as a child already, I was always surrounded in an entourage of, shall we say, what would be the right word? I don't quite know how to describe it. People of a certain background, certain cultural background, but also cosmopolitan.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking and thinking, switching from one language to another, incessantly.
Yes, yes.
And I do that to this day. I very often think something in English, and some thought comes to me in German, and then I think of something in Italian, and I say to myself, no, that's interesting. How would that one be in French?
Yeah.
So I experiment with combinations in French to see what equates with the Italian version.
Yeah. But you went to Gordonstone, didn't you?
Yes. Well, you see, Gordonstone in my day was a German-Jewish refugee foundation which had fled from Hitler. Originally, it wasn't Gordonstone at all. It was called Schule Schloss Salem, which means the school in the castle Salem. Or to use an Americanization, Salem becomes Salem.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Salem was the castle of Prince Max von Baden, who was the prince of a large part of German South Germany. And he had a German-Jewish, very brilliant, private secretary called Kurt Hahn, H-A-H-N, to whom I'm indefinitely and immensely grateful. Anyhow, Hahn founded, under the patronage of Prince Max, a small private school in the precincts, well, in one of the wings of the Castle Salem, which is in the extreme south of Germany, near Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And pupils there included the man who is now the husband of our queen, Prince Philip, nominally of Greece, but very largely, I gather, or wholly, I'm not sure which, very largely of German origin. And it also included the two sons of Prince Max. And when the Nazi gangsters came to power in 1934, they arrested Kurt Hahn. How dare he, filthy Jew, run a school?
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately for him, he had been in his youth educated in Oxford University, where he learned to know friends who later became bishops of the Church of England and archbishops. And when these people heard what had happened, they intervened through the then Ramsay MacDonald government, he then being then the Prime Minister, and the Gestapo on this intervention let Hahn out.
Mm-hmm.
He fled to Britain together with most of his boys, many of their families and staff. The whole thing fled, or a large part of it fled, and re-established in Scotland in an old house called Gordonstone.
Uh-huh.
And Prince Philip of Greece, or the Duke of Edinburgh, whichever you prefer, began his schooling when it was still in Germany and was there in the school for about a year before he, amongst others, fled to Britain and spent the remaining schooling years in the school in Scotland.
Right.
And I was there during the war when it had to move again because the Scots were so bellicose and anti-German. Dirty Germans, get out! So they had to get out, and they went to Wales, where they were fortunate in that the father of some of the boys was a certain Lord David Davis, a Welshman, who owned a number of mansions near a village called Llandinam, which was between Newtown and Llanidloes, look you, in the Severn Valley in Montgomeryshire. Oh, indeed, to goodness. And they were perfectly angelic. They couldn't have been sweeter, these Welsh people. And there we were, and I was schooled there for 3.5 years during the war.
All right. We have to whiz forward a bit to Christmas in Elgar's house in Hampstead.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Didn't you live in Elgar's house in Hampstead?
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, now, you see, my mother came to England and married an Englishman, the son of a salt magnate named Henry Seddon of Cheshire. She married the son of this salt magnate in 1911. And they bought a house in 1921 in Hampstead. It was a great, magnificent Norman Shaw mansion. And it was named by the previous owner was Sir Edward Elgar, the master of the king's music and composer. And he was brought up in the area of the River Severn. And he loved the River Severn in Malvern and similar places. And he named that house Severn House, S-E-V-E-R-N. And I was born in that house. They bought it in 1921. I was born in it in 1926. And I was brought up in it. It had a magnificent, huge music room, which was really a sort of almost a small concert hall in the midst of the house. And I was brought up in it until my English father went off with a bitch named the Honourable Mrs. Russell, the wife of a Colonel Russell. And that would have been around about 1936 or 7. And he left us all in the lurch with no money. So the house couldn't be kept going, and the boilers, having no fuel, burst and cracked and would have cost an enormous sum of money to repair. And in any case, there was no money to buy the fuel. So the house, in a ruinous condition, had to be sold for scrap for all of £2,000, which at that time had quite a different valuation from what it has today. And there we were, homeless, in a dreadful state. And that is the situation, really. We were moving from pillar to post and furnished rooms to bungalows to flats to whatever could be accommodated. And in that situation, Kurt Hahn discovered us, I think, through the Jewish environment in Hampstead and Golders Green. And his method of choice of pupils was quite remarkable. It was by personal selection. So he came to see us in whatever hovel we then happened to be living in, and he immediately was favourably impressed and decided to give me what amounted to being a scholarship. And that is how I came to Gordonston.
I see. Okay. All right, Maurice. Well, I'm sort of running out of time a bit, so thank you very much for your time and for delivering the Wavelength Christmas message, and we wish you a warm and cheerful Christmas, and I'll see you on Sunday.
And I wish you all the very best, and I must apologise. I hope I haven't deviated onto wrong subjects.
Not at all, no.
To discuss relevant ones.
No, not at all, not at all. Thank you very much.
All the very best.
Thank you. Bye.
Adieu.
Bye.
Adieu.